I'm going to be here next. Yeah, I'm going to be here in front of me. What's your name?
I'm Jason.
Jason Bloom?
Yes.
Okay. But I'm since the topics are open over here, so I'm open to other topics as well if you want. So you let me know what you want to discuss. It's my pleasure if I'm capable of discussing it. The topic today is that of Tefillas Kelim. Okay, what do you know about Tefillas Kelim, first of all? What's that?
It's it has to be like the same type of mikvah that you would like may need.
Correct, the different kinds of mikvahs. Let's start with that, all right? What are the different times that we use mikvahs? Women use a mikvah, you've studied already with Rabbi Simon, Hilchos Nida. Right, so women have to go to a mikvah when they complete their menstruation. That's one kind of a mikvah. And then we go to mikvah when we have new dishes. All right, well, that's all discussed today. When else do we use a mikvah?
Made by goyim, right?
Men sometimes go to mikvah.
When do men go? Dishes made by goyim.
Only dishes made by goyim. Correct. That's why in Eretz Yisrael, if the dishes are made by Jews, we wouldn't take them to mikvah. Then men have to go. Right, only glass and metal.
What's the deal with that? I heard people say that you don't necessarily need a
total
glass. That just
means. That's in the two major misconceptions about Tefillah. That's one of them. Glass has to be total. The glass is not a mitzvah in a Torah, it's a mitzvah in a Rabbanim. That's the difference between glass and metal. But just to finish up this point of the different kinds of mikvahs. Then men tell us, when do men go to a mikvah? Before Shem Yom Kippur, sometimes some chassanim before they get married go to mikveh. Sometimes a person before a bris will go to mikveh. All right. Now, you're correct in saying is that it's not all the same deal. In other words, when a woman goes to mikveh after she menstruates, so that is a mitzvah deraisa for going to mikveh. And if she doesn't go to mikveh, so then to have relations with her is also min haTorah, the isur korbeis. That's the most significant form of going to mikveh. That's the most important kind of going to mikveh. And when we get the Beis HaMikdash back, then we'll all have to go to mikveh for different situations. If a Kohen wants to work in Beis HaMikdash, we'll have to go to mikveh. It's part of becoming Torah. When we bring karbonis, and any of us who are not Kohenim, we'll have to go to mikveh. So there'll be many times when we'll go to mikveh when we get the Beis HaMikdash back. But nowadays, when men go to mikveh, it's in the category of a minhag. So it can't be a minhag. So therefore, going to mikveh before Rosh Hashanah is a minhag. Going to mikveh before Yom Kippur, according to some opinions, is more important. According to some opinions, I wouldn't say it's a mainstream view, but it's significant, is that going to mikveh before Yom Kippur, according to some, is a mitzvah deraisa. That's why, of all the times that men go to mikveh, Yom Kippur is the most popular. Right? Then some will go to mikveh before Yom Tov, because there's a mitzvah to become Torah before Yom Tov. But nowadays, that's also in the category of a minhag. There are some people, primarily Hasidim, who go to mikveh when they before davening. Right? What's that based on? So that's based on an interesting situation which never became a din for us. In the time of the Mishnah, there was a movement by Rabbi Yehuda, I believe, to establish that all men should go to the mikveh after they've been with their wives. Whenever a man is about care, whenever a man has a seminal emission, right after he's been with his wife, even though it's a heter gomer, even a mitzvah, he may have had a child out of that, right? But there was a midin de raisa, whenever I have a seminal emission, I become tummy for a day. I can't go into Beis HaMikdash that day. So there was a move by the Tanoim to insist that men, before they, if they've been with their wives, so then they should go to mikveh before they daven, and before they learn. And that was the different views as to why, what was the basis for that. Some said the basis for that was to show an extra sense of the sanctity of learning, that I don't just go from the bedroom back to the base of Medrash. And others say that it was in order to discourage frequency with one's wife. They knew that one had to go to mikveh in the morning before one would daven, so then one would make a cheshbon of when one would not be with one's wife all as frequently as otherwise. Then, however, whatever the reason for it was, this is one of the classic situations of exera she'ein atzibi yichol lamod ba. We have a rule in halacha that whenever the rabbon, whenever the rabbis made a rule, they only made legislation if they evaluated that the tzibur, the community, would be able to withstand that exera. In fact, whenever the rabbanon made exera, there was always a two-step process. Step number one was they announced exera, and they would not announce their reason for the exera. Why would they announce the reason?
People would do it and didn't like that.
Because everybody would say that Gzeira makes a lot of sense for everybody else. But for me, I don't need that Gzeira, right? They make a Gzeira, let's say, not to climb a tree in Shabbos, because maybe you'll come to pick the fruit, right? So maybe you'll break, right? So everybody would say, I'll remember. Now, guys, I don't remember. But I remember. I have a good focus. The guys have ADD, all right, they have to work with these things, not me. So everybody makes their own kind of exera. Halacha is he can't read very close to a lamp because maybe he'll come to tilt the lamp. So people would say, in fact, the Gemara says, Yishmol Taka said, to me it doesn't apply. I'll remember. I don't get so, but there are guys who get so involved in their reading and they don't think of anything else. So Chazal never announced the reason because they didn't want everybody to make their own cheshbonos. However, hold on, remember the question? However, they would let it go for a year. And then after a year, they would send out agents throughout the country and see, are the people keeping Gzeira or not? If the people are keeping the Gzeira, and it's Yechol La'amod Ba, and people can handle it, then they would announce the reason and teach the reason. And if, on the other hand, people couldn't handle it, so then they would repeal, they would let the Gzeira die, or they would repeal it. So this is a classic example, that they announced this rule, all men, after being with their wives, have to go to mikveh. And then a year later they checked out and they saw people couldn't handle it. They couldn't keep it. They had a mikveh every morning, the wife less, it wasn't working. So they let the gzeira die. And that's why nowadays it's not a halach at all. There are groups of people who do keep it, usually chassidim, although you find it's not limited to chassidim. When I was growing up, I thought only chassidim kept it. But I found after it's not so. And the Hasidim who do keep it, or the groups who keep it, they keep it across the board because they don't want that whoever goes to mikveh in the morning, somebody's going to know he was with his wife the night before. So they make it across the board. All these Hasidim have to go every morning. In Yerushalayim, for example, Yerushalmis, old Yerushalmis, so many of them go to mikveh every single day. I remember when I was in Yerushalayim, I was training under an older Rav. He was, at that time, he must have been in his 70s, but I'm not sure, maybe even older. Sholem Eisen. He was one of the poskim of the old Yerushalmi Yishuv. He was one of the Yerushalmis that was open to Americans. I wanted to learn practical halachas. I wanted to sit by somebody who was paskening. So he paskened every day for about 2 hours. He had a 2-hour slot. He sat in the base of Edrash, and then I would... people would come to Shilas, and I would sit in the women's section, so in case somebody came with an embarrassing question, they wouldn't know somebody's listening in. And then after 2 hours, I would pop out, and I'd walk him home, and then we'd go over everything which came up, and he would explain to me why he said what he said. So as we were walking home one day, it was 12 o'clock in the morning, he said, I'm so tired. So I must have looked very surprised. It was 12 o'clock in the morning. So he looked at me and said, you're wondering why I'm tired? He says, because I put in a full day already. He says, because he used to get up every morning at 3 o'clock in the morning, 3:30 in the morning, he would daven masikin, right? He would daven with the sunrise every morning. So first he would go, he said, everybody went to mikveh first. And after going to mikveh, then he went down to the coastal. He daven masikin. So at 12 o'clock, he had already put in 8 hours already. He had learned and he'd passed him 2 hours. He had put in a full day. I was still my fresh juices then. So there are people who go to mikveh every single day, and they keep it either because of the old gezeira or because because Chazal did say that this is an elevated way of learning and davening. So, but however, the big however is coming to this point, what you were saying before. However, when a men's mikveh does not nearly have the same standards as a woman's mikveh, nothing like cleanliness, that's also true. They don't have the same standards as cleanliness. But a men's mikveh is a different kind of a mikveh. It doesn't have to have all of the inner workings, if you want, we can discuss it some other time, of how a woman's mikveh. A woman's mikveh is made in a very particular fashion so that the water that the women go into is conjoined with the rainwater. And a men's mikveh sometimes has that those regulations, sometimes that doesn't have that those regulations. So that's why a woman also has to be careful if she's traveling to make sure that if she pops into a mikveh, that and it'll always be that way, that she's going to a kosher woman's mikveh. And the kelim mikveh has the same standards as a woman's mikveh. You can't bring kelim to a man. You can bring kelim to a woman's mikveh. You can bring kelim to a kelim mikveh. You can bring kelim to an ocean, a lake. You also have to figure out most whether a lake would be a good kelim mikveh or not. What's your question before?
Why can you follow? Why can you not follow the zayin or when something applies to you?
So that's a good question. So let's explain that from the question is the following. The question is basically you're asking what is the basis for the authority within the rabbanon. Right? In other words, the rabbis made a zayin. So you're asking, what's your name?
Chaim.
Is there a Chaim over here?
I'm Jeffrey.
Chaim Jeffrey Green. Chaim again. What's your last name?
Rotenberg.
Rotenberg, right, Jeffrey and Chaim Rotenberg, good. So what Chaim's asking is a fundamental question. Let's discuss it for a moment. The rabbis make a gzeira, right? The rabbis make a rule. What's the purpose of the rabbis making a gzeira? Kadosh Baruch Hu didn't tell them to make the rule, they made it up, right? Why are they doing it? To help us. Because they want us to be able to observe the halacha better, all right? They want us to be able to make sure that we don't pluck fruits from trees. They want us, why can't we ride a horse? Because he may pluck a branch to beat the horse, right? Why can't we read by a certain light? If it's very, very close, they're afraid that we will tilt the light. So almost all din of the Rabbanon, almost all of them, and certainly all gezeiros are there for our benefit, to help us out. All right? So what Chaim's asking is, so why isn't every rabbinic rule really a suggestion? All right? In other words, the Kadosh Baruch Hu tells what he wants. He gave us the Rosh Hashanah, gave us the Rosh Hashanah. Now, Torah Kadosh Baruch Hu came along and said, Rabbanon have the right to establish rules. The Rabbanon's primary goal is to establish rules that will help us keep the din day raisa. So that's a good suggestion. Why do we take it to the where does it get bumped up to a all-embracing responsibility and obligation for everybody to keep? So there are two answers to that question. One answer to the question is that systems don't work that way. In other words, when the rabbis decided to make a gzeira, they never did it frivolously. They took it very, very seriously. And they would never make a gzeira unless they understood that most people need this help, need this gzeira. The rabbis were very, very self... what's it called? Self-legislated. They themselves self-regulated. They themselves checked themselves very carefully and took it very seriously. And in fact, if the rabbis would add on a gzeira unnecessarily, then this is a point that Rabbi Shechter points out from a Rashi in the very beginning of Masechta Zveya. Then they were in violation of unnecessarily adding to the Torah. That's how serious it is. The Torah says, "Vasisa mishmeres l'mishmarti." You should make a fence around my Torah. Below mishmeres l'mishmeres, but you cannot make additional fence unnecessarily. So the rabbis had certain self-regulation. They would never, very rarely, make a gzera to protect their own gzera. Very rarely. Sometimes it's very rarely. So why? Because they understood that by making a gzera, so they were adding on to the Rabbanu Shem's rules. So that's, you can't take that lightly. That's a serious business. So they would only make a gzeira if they understood that most people need this help. Right? And in fact, there's a Gemara that exactly addresses your problem, your question. The Gemara in Shabbos. So the Gemara says that Chazal made the rule that people should not read right next to a lamp on Shabbos. An electric light is probably okay, but a lamp on Shabbos. So the was Rabbi Yishmael who said, "I'm going to be okay." And then the story was that Rabbi Yishmael, in the middle of while he was learning, the lamp began to flicker, and he went to see what he was learning, and he got more involved, and he ended up tilting the wick or the lamp so that the oil went to the wick, and he was over the Yisrael Raisa of Hav Or on Shabbos. And then he said, "Pay silly, I deserve this. Because I thought that I was above rabbinic understanding." There is an apocryphal story. I don't know if it is at all true or not. There is a story that's told in the yeshivas that on a Friday night in Volozhin was they called the mother of yeshivas. Now Volozhin is a yeshiva in Yerushalayim, but Volozhin obviously came originally from Volozhin. That was his first, and it was the flagship yeshiva in Europe. Everybody wanted to be like Volozhin. Volozhin was besides being a yeshiva that required a certain amount of rigor. And it was a yeshiva that was really on the forefront of battling the battle of the Haskalah at that time. In other words, the young Jews were very taken by intellectual curiosity, by the intellectual ferment of Europe at that time. So Volozhin was one of the goals of Volozhin was to try to create the same intellectual environment and learning. So you had a lot of people in Volozhin who were a lot of genii in Volozhin. A lot of people in Volozhin who really their minds were in the science of the times and the culture of the times. It was exciting times in Europe at that time. And so Volozhin was known to be, Rav Kook, for example, one of the great Talmidim of Volozhin. Kook, when he was in Volozhin, learned, I think, 40 blood a day. You know, that's the kind of genius he had running around Volozhin. So there is a story, and I have no idea if it's correct at all, that Friday night in Volozhin, after the Shabbos meal, they all went back to learn. And one of the lamps in the Beis HaMedrash began to dim and go out. So in the middle of the Beis HaMedrash, they were so involved in learning, and this was such a troubling thing, the guy took a ladder, climbed up, and fixed the lamp. Right? Because they didn't realize, Friday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, so I don't know if it's true or not. That's a story that's told. So coming back to your point, so the Gemara asked that question. The Gemara says, Number one, when the rabbis made Gzeira, they were very, very careful. It had to be something that most people needed. Number two, they never made it, if it was B'mokom Choli, for example, if they thought it would create a lot of aggravation, a little bit of aggravation is not bad, but a lot of aggravation, or a lot of pain, they didn't make the Gzeira. They said, you're relieved from the Gzeira, B'mokom Chak, B'mokom Choli. And they understood they wouldn't make a gzeira if most people couldn't handle the gzeira. They didn't want to create unnecessarily. There was no point in making a regulation that people couldn't handle. And they did all of this because they understood that they are adding on to the core, adding on to God's halacha. It's like in America nowadays, the different levels of. I'm not an American, so that's why I'm not so familiar with this. But you know, this is mother's milk for you, right? If the Congress wants to add on, so the different they can add on they can make laws, right? They can make amendments, but unless it changes the Constitution of the United States of America, right? So that requires.
Well, that's to go through the Congress and go back to the people and decide if they want.
Right. And so that is a much higher standard than making and passing new legislation. Why? Because to touch the Constitution. That's in an American mind. That's kutchin, right? That's kutchin. That's and for good reasons, because the Constitution in America has accomplished what most other nations are not able to accomplish. The Constitution is a fantastic document and made by a human being. It's mind-boggling sometimes when you think about what America accomplished. It wasn't accomplished before. So alachas kama v'kama, when human beings are adding on to God's Torah. So they're going to do it with a tremendous amount of concern and pacha. It has to be rabbis, and the 72 rabbis in Yerushalayim can be done without a major basis. And now, so once they did it, so reason number one is, why does it become binding? Because they only did it if most people needed it. Number two, the second reason is because a system of laws only works if it is all-embracing. Right? Moshul Ma'adavar Daima. You run a stop sign at 3 a.m. in the morning. Right? And you get nailed by the police car. Right? So if you say to the police, look, officer, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and no one ever uses these streets. And I was in a major rush, and I know that they're going to be safe if they ran the stop sign. In fact, they even looked ahead. So the police will say, we'll laugh at you, right? Why? You have a good time. Because a system doesn't work if everybody, a social group, society cannot work if everybody makes their own cheshbonos. Right? So the rabbis also had a system, that's what's called in the Gemara, imkei nasata debrecha l'shiurin. Means once you give your rules over to be manipulated by any individual group, it's not going to last. It won't be a system. So it won't work for anybody. Right? And the third answer to your question, all of these are correct and part of the system, is that once the rabbis make a rule, then it is backed by God's authority. Right? And the Torah says, Lo yisosu, the pasuk in Shoftim, Lo yisosu mikol asher yerucha, don't veer away from anything which they teach you. So that means the Rabbonu Shalom is saying, it now becomes my rule.
Right,
so it becomes as important a rule.
Small,
you got it.
Right or not.
Right. Right. That has to be understood. But that means
yeah,
that
Rashi says that, right?
Yeah.
Say, I mean, small they mean yourself.
Right. So that's understood. If they're dead wrong, so then I have to understand what that means exactly. But that's the point. That's the point. Okay? Another follow-up question? Okay, good. So let's get back to Tfilas Kalim. So you have another little background that we did the Rabban. Tfilas Kalim is a mitzvah deraisa, the Bitovo Kalim. It comes from the parish of Matos. Right? Anybody remember what the context is? And what David Belola, remember what parish of Chumash is from? Tfilas Kalim? Matos, correct.
Oh, yeah.
What happened in Matos? Very good. Okay, I'm involved. All right?
Good. We just
get points of being awake also. That's it. Good.
We just had like a huge fight with Moab.
Correct. It was Midian. Midian.
Midian. Started from them. And we had all these Kalim or whatever. And they were specified like six types, right? That we had to bring to.
Six kinds of metal. Correct. Yeah. Six kinds of metal, which raises a very interesting question. I'll come to that in 1 minute. So so Moshe Rabbeinu taught us that when he came back from the fight with Midian. Right? Why did we fight Midian? I remember.
For what, water.
Was
they
that?
Didn't want to sell us the water.
No. Why did we fight Midian?
That's Moab.
Correct. Why Midian? Midian is to my recollection. Go ahead.
I might be Moab, but then the wizard that your friend.
Couldn't hear.
Bilam tricks the Jews into sleeping with Midian. Right?
Correct. Midian, the Midianite women in the battle against Midian. So they sent their women in, and in order to seduce our men. And then once they seduced our men, so then they got us to serve by deserve. So that's how we fought Shed Nechlu B'chlas. That's how we fought Midian. It's the only battle, to my recollection, all of Chumash. It's the only battle that we fought not for land. It wasn't for Eretz Yisrael. It wasn't for self-defense. Right? It was entirely because to establish the importance that we have on living lives that are not licentious, on living lives that are not decadent. It was the only battle, I think, Moshe Rabbeinu said, because they proffered decadence, so we have to make a stand against it. So when we came back, we had Kalim. Now, why did we have Kalim in that battle, not in other battles? Why all of a sudden came? Was that?
Other battles were solely for Hashem. So, but we didn't take stuff just to show that, you know, we weren't doing it to plunder.
I don't think so. A Molech, we didn't plunder at all. But let's say after Mitzrayim, we took stuff from Mitzrayim. Was that?
We didn't go to battle with Mitzrayim.
Yeah, we still had their Kalim, though.
They enslaved us for 250
years. Was that?
We have to tell them that Mitzrayim's Kalim.
We have to tell them anyways. We have to tell them. We would have to tell them. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu teach us this rule, Davka after Midian? So that I think the Ramban explains, because this is the only battle that did not take place on a battlefield. We went into their cities. It wasn't part of a campaign. We went against Moab. So Moab came out of their fields, out of their homes, and waged a battle because they didn't want us to take over their country. The Mitzrayim went after us and caught us in Yamsuf. So when you go out to the battlefield, you don't take dishes and pots and pans with you. You take your little Cub Scout Swiss knives, and you take your the military dishes and stuff like that. No one's going to go home with that. But Midian was a battle that we fought. we fought them in their cities. They didn't attack us, we attacked them. So once we were in their cities, so then we would walk home with some of their good dishes, some of the bring home from the battlefield for your wife, a nice set of dishes, some good pots and pans. Finally get some good pots and pans from the goyim put together. It's a good thing to come home with. So then we came home with these pots and pans, we came home with the animals also. So Moshe Rabbeinu said, whoa. When you have a goyish of pots and pans, you have to know how to kasher them. And number two, he said, we have a new din that we had not practiced otherwise. And that is that before we bring something which goyim made into a Jewish home, the last line, the second last line of the Gemara Yerushalmi of Avodah Zarah explains this rule. It says, what's the point? What's the whole deal with Tevilas Kelim? Why are we bringing Kelim to the mikveh all of a sudden? We're bringing Kelim to the mikveh because when we bring something to which we're going to make a statement. Because Shmuel who wants us to make a statement. Not everything makes right. Not everything makes it in to the Jewish home. It has to go through a process. It's almost like a mezuzah kind of idea. You come into a Jewish home, you have to filter. It's a filter. So if something was made by a guy, of course it's made by the dish is a fine, perfect dish. But we want to make a point that the way that the things that are come into a Jewish home should have should be crafted and made by a Jew, so to speak. So therefore we want to make that statement and make that process. So that we apply to all forms of metal min haTorah, all forms of metal. All forms of earthenware do not require tefillah. Only forms of metal require tefillah min haTorah. Right? Now, then the Rabbanan came along and said, what do we do with glass? Right? When is the earliest form of glass? And you know, when did glass make it on the scene? The first glass we have is from around the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim. You go to Corning in New York, upstate New York. So in the Corning Museum, they had the first shred of glass that we found was from around the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim. They don't say that it was Yetzias Mitzrayim, but you figure it out. It's around Yetzias Mitzrayim. I think it may have been an Egyptian shard of glass. So when so glass is not addressed in the Torah Shemachsav in this parasha. The rabbis had to figure out what category is glass in. How would you analyze it? How would you, if you wanted to figure out, the Torah said earthenware, no mikveh. Metal, yes mikveh.
So you analyze the reasons why earthenware is rejected and why metal is not rejected.
Okay, so we don't really have.
But like, glass more resembles earthenware as far as its origins go.
Oh, okay, good.
It's made from sand.
No, I agree with what I'm saying. Jason was saying, because the whole reasoning is that earthenware was very cheap. Everyone can make it, so it's like kind of like what we eat as disposable.
It's like, why are we only allowed to eat bird with, I don't know, why fish with only a scale? It's like, no one knows.
As we're saying, like, we shouldn't be.
So we don't really understand why Kadosh Baruch Hu said these metals and. We don't really know. Right? Let's say, for example, because let's say you have a kitten out of wood, a bowl out of wood. No. Very carefully. That's what kashering is for. When non-kosher, if a person buys a dish in an auction, right? So that may have had, that has to be kashered, because it may have been used for trade.
So what's the
right? Now, all dishes, no matter what, have to be kashered. Right? There's no dish that wouldn't have to be kashered. Right, so as long as it was used, let's say a person said it. No, this might be an exception. Correct. So you're right. So the glass, according to many svaradim, does not require because glass is seen as a material which is either non-porous or is so. I don't know if you use that word, but it's shua. Shua means that it's so sharp, it's so slippery, so smooth, that it may not absorb. Right, so Ashkenazim are machmer glass and some svarim are makel. That's correct. Let's say it comes up sometimes when a person is missing a dish. You have a set of dishes, and a few of them break. So you go back to the manufacturer. Let's say sometimes you go to the store and you get it, fine. Sometimes you can't go to the store anymore because it's already, what do they call it? They're not producing this dish anymore. So you go to the manufacturer. So sometimes you have to be careful because sometimes the manufacturer will send you new dishes and sometimes the manufacturer has bought up used dishes that they now are sending out in a very, very high-priced way to help people replace broken dishes of their set. So then one has to be very careful, because those have to be kosher. And some that they can't be kosher, if they're earthenware, they can't be kosher. So they're very clear, very important to keep this in mind. Koshering and tefillah are two separate issues. Koshering is if my dish, which could be owned by a Jew or owned by a goy, was used for treif. So I can only use it if I kosher. Separate then, I have a new dish. It was never used, but it was made by goyim. I have to tovel it. I have to bring it to me before. If it's metal or if it's glass. Coming back to this point, when the rabbis analyze glass, so two ways to analyze it. One way is what Belula said, to analyze it via its contents. What's glass made out of? Sand. What's porcelain made out of?
What?
What's porcelain made out of?
Dirt.
Basically the same thing. So therefore, some rabbis said, some chazal, we should look at glass if it's porcelain. Porcelain does not require tefillah. Earthenware doesn't require tefillah. What's the other way to look at it? How is glass made?
So you heat up the glass.
Heat up the sand. It becomes a liquid. It becomes viscous. Right? How do you make earthenware?
Not that way.
Right? I mean, really, you take you make a hard clay out of it and you bake it. It never becomes. How do you make metal?
Melt it.
So if you look at the process, the way the item is made. So glass resembles metal more than it resembles earthenware. So Chazal was saying, the Torah doesn't mention glass. Torah Shavuot doesn't mention glass. Which way do we analyze it? So this is a question, this question comes up twice in Shas. Once when it comes to whether glass is Mekabel Tumah, and once when it comes to require the glass requires tefillah or not. So Chazal made a takona, right? They said, we're not sure, make a takona. That the glass requires tefillah midrabbanan. Midrabbanan, it's not mentioned. Right. Midrabbanan, since it's mentioned, so therefore we have to include it. Therefore, Chazal made it in the rabbanan, and the glass also requires tefillah. Alright?
So,
Ben?
Do you have to tell things that you only use for things you're going to eat?
Things that you're going to
eat?
Correct. Only clay suda. Only has to do, you only have to tumble things that are in contact with food.
Say,
not required tefillah. Only things that are in contact with food.
Isn't there a gemara that says something about, like, if you need to tovel a dog collar or something?
A what?
A collar, like an animal collar.
Tovel animal collar?
Yeah, I remember the came up with a gemara like that. Where
No. That could be a thing.
If it's still on the dog.
If it's, that's a question of when it became tome.
Oh, fine.
That's a different question, right?
Also, isn't the thing with earthenware though, like if it cracks and gets fixed, then it wouldn't even need to be tovel, then it's very prone to that? Like, that's something that's been broken, you don't need to tovel.
You're talking about Tumim Tara. We're saying it's Tumim Tara. Something, if you have earthenware and it broke, then it becomes Tohar, and it's no longer Tumim.
All right.
Now, on the other hand, what is correct, though, is if I would buy a piece of, if earthenware that was made by a goy breaks, and I fix it, and make it usable, so then it doesn't require tefillah, because I made it.
Whoever makes it functional.
Well, like, I mean, I remember that, like, a shot came up, we had like a grilled cheese machine.
Yeah,
and,
okay.
I had to hold that, so we just, like, this thing. Just
so you unassembled it and you reassembled it.
Yeah.
Right, so then it means that you made it. Right, that's correct. That's one approach. What was that?
How do you unassemble a grilled cheese maker?
Because you can't solve
the whole shit. Right, so any kind of electric, let's keep things organized over here. So we discuss now certain principles of rabbinic legislation. That was an answer to Chaim's question. That's number one. Number two is we discuss the source of Tfilas Kalim, the Parsha of Midian. We explained why it came up in the context of Midian, right? And then we explained that what's the Raisa and what's the Rabbanon, right? And so far we're saying that metal requires a glass, not required. Here's an interesting question. What about aluminum? Does aluminum require tefillah or not?
Use it more than once.
Now, what's the question? Right? In other words, what you're raising, what's your name?
Is it a clean?
Jonathan raised another question. He said he alluded to the idea that disposables do not require tefillah. Right? Why is that? Why is a one-use item not required tefillah?
You were already using that.
Who's that?
Before you told it, aren't you?
No, no, that's, there's a misconception. The two major misconceptions of tefillah. Number one is that glass is not required till it's wrong. It doesn't require tefillah. It requires tefillah with a bracha. I've gone into mikvos where there are signs that say glass requires tefillah without a bracha. It's incorrect. Glass requires tefillah with a bracha. It's a regular mitzvah.
I'm sure that they have certain post-commitment.
I think it's a mistake. So, and the second misconception is that people say you're allowed to use a keli once before tefillah. It's also a misconception. You cannot. There is the there's a mitzvah to tovo. Concomitant with the mitzvah to tovo is an iser. It is prohibited to use a dish that requires tefillah without it being tovo. All right. So it's also to use a dish without being tovo if it requires tefillah. There is a misconception, and maybe what you're saying is where it comes from, is that I can use it once and that's good enough. That's wrong. Can't use it. In fact, one of the naughtiest problems that a person get into is if you're invited to somebody's house, right? Let's say, and you're going to a friend's house, or you're invited to, let's say, you're going on a Torah tourist program, and you're somebody else's house. You'll say you're traveling across America, and you work out where you're going to stay in different communities. And then you go, and then as you're in the course of eating dinner, some conversation comes up, and you realize that the Balavatam don't know about Tefillas Kelim. You realize they don't have a clue about taking Kelim to Mikveh. I've had situations where kids have become from, and their parents have been very, very good and were into kasher everything. But when the kid was becoming from, they didn't know about the mitzvah of tefillas kelim. So now they're adults. They come to go visit their parents every so often. All the kelim are kosher kelim, but they've never been told. So what do they do? I always had a situation where, and it becomes a very sensitive issue, because the kasher is a big deal.
So
oh, okay. So now the question is, what do you do in that case? What's the halacha? So there are, this is a situation where there are several kulos, there are several leniencies that we try. This is what we call it, you're in a tight situation. Here you are at somebody else's house, and as you're eating, you find out that it might be usur, that it is usur, to actually use the kalim which you're using. So the question is, what do you do at that point? So you don't want to offend your host. You don't want to. It could be a show and bias issue, correct? So this is a situation we try to figure out. We got to squeak out of this and see if we can find a way. One doesn't get into the situation initially, but we try to find a way to be, especially if a kid who's becoming from. So the parents are going along with everything. So they've gone along with kashering. They haven't yet gone along with the idea of tefillas kelim. So you don't want to create a lot of aggravation if we can avoid it. So the question is, are there ways in which one can be mako? So one way, one suggestion is, there are certain, let's say, leniencies. One thing is to realize that the only thing which requires tevila is metal and glass. Right? So most of your things are going to be okay. Right, the fact that they were cooked, very important point, the fact that food was cooked inside a keli that was not tovel does not make the food osir. So it means it was osir for me to cook the food in the keli, but doesn't make it osir. Once it's cooked, I can allow to eat it. But now I'm eating it. It's osir for me to use kelim that were not tovel. So, first of all, most of my dishes are going to be porcelain. So most of that will not hardly be a problem, right? The chances of using glass dishes, not great. Number two, my big problem is the knives and the forks and the spoons, and the glass that I'm drinking from. So Rav Moshe Feinstein has the following approach, which is again a very significant leniency, but it's a kind of leniency that we employ when a person in a tight situation. He said it's possible. Now, when the Torah said that you have to tovel kelim which you are using, the Torah was saying that kalim which you absolutely need to use, not kalim which you are using even though you don't absolutely need them. So, for example, so that therefore he said most forks and knives are not absolutely necessary. A person, they, we use them for etiquette reasons. Right? You're having a piece of schnitzel. You could hold on to it. You could eat it. Right? You're doing it because it's inappropriate. It's not nice. It's not manners. It's not menschlich. So therefore he says, therefore the usage of your knife and fork is not absolutely necessary. It's really a form of etiquette. You're having a piece of cake. Use a spoon. You don't have to use a spoon. So he suggests that one can be lenient in that regard. So even the plate, you have a glass plate. You could eat it on the table. Right? It'd be chazerish to eat on the table. Right? Totally ill-mannered. But what you're using because of etiquette and manners and to be a mensch, so that's not the level of usage which the Torah requires. It's a chiddush. And again, we would never say to follow this a priori. If I know that these people aren't told in Kalim, I've worked something else up. But if I'm there and I'm having dinner, so then that's so we don't want to offend people. So therefore we try to work out a kula. So that's one suggestion you made. So that would mean that aside from the soup bowl, and aside from the drink, because you don't have soup, and you have the knedel in the soup, you don't have the... Hold on to that question, just finish the thought. And then the drinking glass, aside from that, maybe you could get away, you could make it through, so to speak. So that's one major chiddush of... then there's another major chiddush which also might be... which is helpful in here, and that was suggested by Shlomo Zalman Orbach. He suggested that since I don't have the ability to do Tfilas Kalim, I am not violating Tfilas Kalim. You're only violating Tfilas Kalim if you had the ability to do the mitzvah and you didn't do the mitzvah. But if I never had the chance to do the mitzvah, in other words, he's saying the prohibition of using dishes that were not tovel is the pro, it means it's what you're doing is since you're not keeping the mitzvah of tevila. So when I'm a guest, I don't have the ability to take my host dishes and run to the mikveh with them. Hold on a second. Just to finish the thought. So therefore, I'm not in violation of the Iser. Right? The host is in violation of the prohibition, but I'm not in violation of the prohibition. So those are two approaches that can help a person make it through, so to speak, in a tight situation. All right, go ahead. You're on.
You said the Isser was with cooking something that hasn't been talked about, right? But in this case, you're just eating something that hasn't been
talked about. Right.
So, like, the cooking, like you're saying, it's lesser because it's not the actual cooking; it's just the eating.
No, and Moshe Feinstein would say, yeah, because cooking, you cannot cook without a pot. Right.
Yeah.
So absolutely necessary. So there's no way out of that. Right. So the person who cooked was over an Isser, but it doesn't make the food Isser. Right, if a person cooked milk and meat together, so they did an Iser, and so I said eat it. But if a person cooked in a keli that's not tovel, the cooker was an over an Iser, but I'm not over an Iser eating it. Good.
Also, when do you think something will be even more mafia? Because it's like a double shish matera. I don't only use the more mafia when it's something you can easily reconcile.
No, the double shish matera is more awesome in very specific situations. Halacha, very certain situations. By beetle, right. Go ahead.
If you're like a restaurant, they don't sell all their dishes.
They shouldn't have hashgacha.
But they do. I don't
say that.
No, rabbis will not give hashgacha to
I think it's true.
Was that?
You don't think so? I think Rabbi Yashu says that since you're it's like you're renting the dishes, and they don't say that you don't have to tell them. I know that the rabbanon, I think everywhere it says that you don't have to tell their dishes.
There are certain leniencies that what you're saying is correct. That there are positions, I don't know if it's Rav Yosha, but there are those who hold that a restaurant does not have to tovel kalim because from their perspective, they're not eating dishes, they are business dishes. But I remember you asked me before whether a keli is only also if it's used for food. I said, yeah, only for food. So there are those who've suggested the restaurant use its dishes as tools to make business. Right? So there are those that be needed, but that approach is highly is a non-mainstream approach. So I would
be
surprised.
Why wouldn't they call the Rav Anuga counts on it?
I'd be very surprised if other would have relied on
it. It's in the handbook.
The handbook for whom? For the Rav Anuga. Which Rav Anuga?
I mean, it doesn't matter,
because
it's all the same.
No, all of us are different. In Israel, Rav Anuga for Haifa, Yerushalayim, Tel Aviv.
Yeah, but you have to take one Rav Anuga to take the product of another Rav Anuga. So if it was cooked, let's say I have hummus, I came from Haifa. Was cooked in
a No, but it doesn't make the food usher. No, the food doesn't become usher.
That's also why I want that. Why is it not usher Bahana? One point at a time.
So it's coming back to this point. So this is I'm learning something that you're saying that some, but you have to realize two things. Number one,
this is the way it was when I was in Yeshiva 3 years ago.
No, it could be. I trust it. I'd say in America, I'd be very surprised. And unless if in America a hashgacha would give a hashgacha where they came in Atol.
It's
one thing. When I make it clear. So, but I could easily understand that in a situation where it's very important to give hashgacha. And if one doesn't give hashgacha, people might be eating inappropriately. That Rabban would be lenient and follow this approach, but it's a non-mainstream approach. Again, in America, we probably would not follow it, and I would be surprised if in Eretz Yisrael, the different rabbanim have different standards. So it's
I don't remember people say that. Why is it different standards? If a rabbi makes a psak a certain way, Why shouldn't everyone be able to use a psak? Saying it's only use that psak because they won't listen to what I really hold? No, I don't think that's the way it is.
That's the way it's really been in many situations.
No, a rabbi makes some psaks because that's the way he feels that the sugya is illustrated in a certain way. So that's the way he paskins. I don't understand why you would say that the rabbi gives certain psak for certain. For sure.
There's certain situations, for sure. Take this situation. All right, this situation. Let's say I have a community that where they're eating in a certain restaurant, and the restaurant is open for me to give them hashgacha, and therefore I'll make sure the community is eating kosher, and it's under my supervision. If I tell the restaurant owners, you're gonna have to take all of your dishes and take them to mikveh, they say, buddy, rabbi, I don't need you. All right. So in that situation, that's a perfectly responsible thing for a rabbi to say, look, I have to measure what I can gain and what I can lose. If I take the mainstream view over here, my Baal HaBatim will not be in kosher. If I take a minority view on the Tefillas Kelim, my Baal HaBatim will be kosher. So I gain a lot. So I could easily see, I'm speculating, I'm saying based on what you're telling me, it's important to understand the way Halacha works. I could easily say that it would be entirely responsible and the correct thing to do, and you and I should be entirely somach on them. That they could say, I have a city in Eretz Yisrael, I want to have as many restaurants under hashgacha as possible, because every restaurant is being eaten, the Jews are eating there, right? So I want to get kashrus, I'm going to push and get kashrus in every single restaurant. Now if I go to some restaurant and they're not going to listen to Tevilas Kelim, so I lose. So I gain by taking a minority view, and then we should all be somech, but you're saying it's correct. It would be appropriate for everyone to be somech on the rabbi who makes that decision. Right? But that doesn't mean that a rabbi in Yerushalayim would necessarily adopt that view. Right? That's how it works.
So you say things like minority view, then it becomes the majority view if everyone in Israel is holding like it. It's like...
You're saying that'd be correct.
There's these terms that are like everyone and minority views and things like this that I just don't think are that simple. And who's to say that if Rabbi Yashiv would make a sock that people could eat in a restaurant that were his payment Martin Tobel, who's to say that, oh, he didn't mean this, he meant that, or he wouldn't really make that sock, but since he has this dilemma.
I'm explaining to you, I'm being very clear and open that I'm speculating based on the information you've given me. All right. Based on you telling me this is the way it comes up in most forum, I'm open to different. There's different looking at things. 100%. And I agree with you that using the term minority and mainstream views has to be done with great care, and I'm employing that care.
Okay, and I
agree. We agree in principle.
I also want to know. You said that you're not allowed to to eat the. You are allowed to eat the food. Just like,
go
just
listening.
You put them in, but I don't understand why it would be any different from any. If you violated any Isra Doraisa per se, right? Why would you not allowed to be nanny from that?
No, it's not correct. Not there are different kinds of Isurim. Some Isurim are an Isur Pu'ula. The act is Asur, but they don't have an Isur impact afterward. And some have an Isur impact afterward, right? So not every... let's say... Take a very good example. Let's say if I don't put on tefillin one day, so I was mevatel the mitzvah say putting on tefillin. Is there an impact afterward? No, not every. Let's say in the case of does it come up in cooking?
That's an asik, not a low asik.
You want a low asik example?
Low
where asik.
I mean, a simple example would be okay. Shabbos. Anything you violate on Shabbos, you're not allowed to be nana from afterwards.
You are, but doesn't make the food awesome. I can't be nana. It's a good example. In other words, let's say a person cooks on Shabbos.
Yeah.
They cook b'mezid, so I have to wait the amount of time it would take after Shabbos to make that food.
Right.
So I'm not nana from the fact that they violated Isur and Shabbos.
Right.
The food doesn't become treif. Right? The food is still kosher. I can eat it a little bit later.
Okay, but there's still the fact that you have to wait till after Shabbos to be nana.
So that's
there's
a,
no, there's
right,
nothing
that,
like that. Why shouldn't you have to be, you should, so then for the food that I made in a kli that was full, I should have to wait the amount of time.
No, because that's not a universal din for all halachas. For example, let's say a person... Let's say the classic one of the classic lavin is that I can't muzzle my ox when he threshes. Let's say I do muzzle my ox when he threshes. I'm allowed to benefit from the threshing. So not every mitzvah lavin in the Torah does the Torah say sometimes it's aser. Sometimes the Torah said it's aser and it's a severe iser, so you cannot benefit from the iser. Sometimes the Torah said it's aser. You blew it. You messed up. All right. But now you go on. Right, so this is an example of the second. Right, not every lav that one does makes the food awesome. Or
so
makes
then,
it make.
Maybe wouldn't there be a tzidra maybe to eat the food?
No,
here,
no. They didn't. In other words, came back to your first year earlier question. The rabbis did not. If the rabbis would have thought that by making an Easter to eat it, it would have taking care of a problem of Tfilas Kelim, they may have done it, but they never did it because either they felt that Jews were being Tovel Kelim, or they felt that this would not be a way to fix up a problem. So they didn't do it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I heard when it comes to like giving certification for restaurants, it might like depend on like religious level of the community. So like if the community is not religious, and so we would be more lenient when you give the certification. Like in, I heard that there was a case in Mexico where there was no kosher restaurant in the city, and they wanted to have one because people would go to the non-kosher restaurant. So they were looking for the leniencies when they were trying to open the kosher restaurant.
It makes a sense to reason that rabbis would do that for sure. Now looking for leniencies doesn't mean that they were letting people do things that were prohibited, but it means that they would rely on non-mainstream views because they were going to accomplish something that was much greater for the community. Yeah. Question before?
About like the temporary value, like touch on appointment and be that way connect. So what is the halacha with like the plastic bottle?
So things that are disposable. One-time use things and halacha are not considered to be kelim. They don't become tamei, and therefore we understand that one-time use things.
Is it what's generally understood as one-time use, or would you decide you want to use? I have a metal fork, and I don't want to talk about it. I'm hungry, so obviously you didn't throw it out.
No, but most people, what you could do if you're in your situation, what you could do is you could be mafkir the fork. You could say anybody can take this fork if they want. So hefker is not required to be looked.
What do you have to do to be
mafkir and answer? And answer.
Just like even if there's no one in the room.
Yeah, it has to be genuine. In other words, you actually have to not have ownership of the fork. You as long as it's genuine at the time. Was that?
You can repossess it.
You can as long as the person's honest. Yeah, as long as you're honest with yourself.
That's really difficult.
So
I'll tell you a good story. That was, I believe, I heard the story of Aaron Lichtenstein, Rashid of the Gush, that there are certain, as you began to mention before, certain electric appliances which are often difficult to tovel, because if you tovel them, you could ruin the electric connections. So there are many different approaches people have. You gave one example before of disassembling it and then reassembling it by Jews, right? So there are different approaches. Some say that you can. Moshe held you can tovel as much that if you can tovel the surface that touches the food, that's good enough, right? But there are different approaches. So his approach was to be mafkir. He would be mafkir his toaster oven or his sandwich maker, I'm not sure. So one Purim, one of the boys, he knew that was the Rebbe's view, so he walked off with the toaster oven because it was the Rebbe's mafkir. Okay, so Matzoi Purim, Shishan Purim, he wanted to bring it back, and his Rebbe would not take it back. Ravan would not take it back. He could not prevail on to take it back. He said, I think it was Mafkir. He was done. He's not taking it back. You can imagine that Talmud felt very bad after. And he ripped off his Rebbe's electric appliance. But that has to be genuine, it has to be honest. If a person's not honest about it, so then that doesn't do anything.
Yeah, but what do you know?
What's that?
Like, I know no one's coming into my house.
It has to be genuine. It has to be a situation. It has to be a situation where if somebody would take it, you would not be, you wouldn't flinch. Right? But let's say, for example, that's what I tell people, aluminum pans. So aluminum pans have two reasons why they would not require tefillah. Reason number one is it's disposable. Right? Reason number two is because aluminum is a metal that was discovered recently. Right? In the time of the Torah, they didn't have, when the Torah was given, aluminum was not known. So the question is, if a new metal is discovered, is it included in the din or not? All right? What would that be based on? Who knows how to analyze that? How do you analyze it? The Torah says, remember you said before, it lists six different kinds of metal. So I think it was the Vilna Gaon that said that since it lists six types of metal, so here the Torah wasn't saying all forms of metal. The Torah told you, Bedil and Eifarves, six times. So you find a new metal doesn't require. On the other hand, other poskim said that the Torah was defining for us metals by telling us the six that were known at that time. And we should understand on our own that it includes all forms of metal. And they go further, how do you say metal in Torah? Rose. No, that's iron. How do you say metal?
Matechet.
What's matechet come from? What is the verb that matechet is related to? What's latich?
Latich.
Which means what?
No,
la'tiach is, no, this is the head of it. La'tiach
is to melt.
To melt, right. So he said that really metal is any substance which can be melted or smelted down. So that would include aluminum. That's the machlokas of poskim. Is aluminum required to be or not required to be? Like aluminum pan, aluminum pot. So many say you would not make a bracha. You have to tovel it because we're not sure, but you don't make a bracha on it. So an aluminum pan has two reasons to be lenient. Number one is disposable, and that's a bona fide, that in itself stands on its own. It doesn't require tefillah. Reason number two is it's aluminum, not sure it requires tefillah. On the other hand, sometimes people use aluminum pans many, many times. So then,
it doesn't make it not disposable, though. If you say something that wouldn't be considered disposable, but you do throw it out, you can't call it disposable. So if you're something that someone uses a bunch of times, even though by the masses it's considered disposable, should still be the same rules as disposable.
Right. But the confusion that we're having is because I'm using the English word. The halachic word over here, is it called a keli or not? A keli is something that services more than one set of contents. So the question, right? Once it's used more than once, it may already be called a keli. I'm using the word disposable to make it more practical, but really the question is used more than once. So therefore, if I use an aluminum pan several times, it may require tefillah. Now, and exactly what Balula was saying, that's really the issue. It's hard to evaluate. When does something become a keli of substance? So, since it's not clear, what I would suggest, and I'll give you another reason why you may be able to not tovel it. Because, exactly what Blue was saying, he's saying that the guy in the store sold it for one usage. If a guy decides to use it more than once, then it's the Jew who decided to use it more than once that really gave it the new status of a keli. The goy, when he gave it the status of a non-keli. When I decided to use it a second or third time, so I gave it the status of a keli.
Therefore
it could be made by a Jew.
Exactly.
So when I tell people that, so it's a suffix, that's why halacha lamasa, we don't tovel aluminum pans.
Is a dent considered breaking something?
No, it has to make it rendered not usable. All right? So what I suggest to people, if they want to be more stricter, is that they can be mafkir. They have in mind, whenever I buy an aluminum pan, I am mafkir. All right? Now, in fact, that I think is a valid hefker. Because let's say somebody comes to your door and says, can I borrow an aluminum pan? So you're not going to say, I want one back. All right? Say, take it. All right? Let's say when your mother makes some kind of food in an aluminum pan, lasagna or something, and she gives it to a friend, doesn't expect to get the aluminum pan back. So there's a genuine kind of hefker. Even though you don't have a note in your door, all aluminum pans in this place of hefker, you didn't make an announcement, right? You didn't text all your friends, but the fact is it's a genuine hefker. So that would be an example of a genuine hefker. So let's just summarize a few of the halachas we made. We suggested, we discussed, that one-time usage is not... The fact that I'm using it for the first time is that's also even without tevilah. However, a keli which is designed, made, sold for one-time usage does not require tevilah. Yeah, go ahead.
For like a plastic.
Plastic bottle, does not require tevilah.
And a glass Coke bottle.
That's a very good question. Let's say you have a Snapple bottle, glass Coke bottle. So are you allowed to drink from the glass? Right? You're allowed to buy Snapple. Was that?
Shafter said from a glass spot you shouldn't drink.
Right. Shafter holds that the glass that you buy Snapple, so you have to pour the drink out into a cup to use. Why? Because I buy the bottle and the juice and the Snapple, and so I bought my Snapple and I bought a keli to use it to drink from. So therefore, I should my keli requires tevilah. Just bought it from a goy. Others would say that since it's a one-time usage,
you're drinking.
Yeah.
Keli, so I'm not using it.
Why not?
You're not reusing it.
I'm not reusing, but I'm using it.
The first time, it's not.
No, if it says a problem.
It's not.
The only reason to be makel, I think, is when you look at this, that it may not be a keli, because most people do not reuse their Snapple bottles.
So if you did reuse it, you can't do that.
No, that's what Balul said. I would think that many rabbanim would say that since most people do not reuse their Snapple bottles, it doesn't become it is not a keli. And if you do reuse it, then you're the minority who reuses it. So then maybe it would require it to be maybe then.
Same thing as a tin
though.
Same thing as a tin though. The guy made it.
Correct, I agree. I think you're saying it's correct. Yeah, go ahead.
Can someone totally read this story?
As long as they're adults, as long as they're bar mitzvah, yeah.
And their bracha, you go to their bracha of tefillah?
Well, the bracha is the bracha and the mitzvah tefillah, so they get the mitzvah and they get the bracha.
Let's say I was helping my brother to tovel his dishes. If he makes a bracha, am I allowed to tovel any of the dishes?
You can. Or you can make your own bracha, yeah.
I have to make bracha.
You don't have to, no. You can do either way. You can be yotzi with his bracha, or you can make your own bracha. You know the one. What's it again? Whenever you have a bracha said mitzvah, you don't say the bracha, the mitzvah is still a good mitzvah. Without saying the bracha, the tefillah is a good tefillah. But the best way to do a mitzvah is to do the bracha before. So you want to be yotzi his bracha. In order to do the mitzvah the best possible way. Okay, if you want, we can continue next time, or if you want a different topic, please let me know. Or it's up to you. I'm open.
All right.
Okay, it's been a pleasure. Yeah, the two guys came in late. What's your name?
Daniel Kalish.
Kalish.